This is the Comics Alternative, episode 207, reviews of The Lost Work of Will Eisner, Libby's Dad, and Blubber Number 3. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Comics Alternative. I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy, and we're two guys with PhDs talking about comics.
And on this week's episode, Andy and I are going to be discussing three recent titles. We're going to begin with a new book, The Lost Work of Will Eisner. After that, we're going to look at Eleanor Davis's Libby's Dad. And then we're going to wrap up with issue number 3 of Blubber from Gilbert Hernandez, or let us say the warped mind of Gilbert Hernandez. But before we get into those discussions, we want to let all of you guys know that this episode of the Comics Alternative is brought to you by the great folks at Discount Comic Book Service. Go to their website, dcbservice.com, for all of your comics pre-ordering needs. There, you're going to find all DC, Marvel, Image, and Dark Horse titles at 40% off the cover price if you pre-order. For all of the other publishers, you'll find that those discounts are 20 to 35% off the cover price. And every single month, you're going to find some unbelievable specials. Now, sometimes those specials can be as much as 45% off the cover price, sometimes as much as 50% off cover. But every now and again, you can find discounts that go higher than that.
That's right, and right now, actually, this month, you can get Blubber issues 2, 3, and 4 on DCB service, each for $2.59. So we're going to talk about issue number 3, but issue 4 solicited, and there's still copies of issue 2 available.
That's right, and if you read all of those issues of Blubber, one right after another, it'll do something to you. What? Well, listen to what we discuss later in the episode. But definitely get your comics at dcbservice.com. They'll take care of all of your comics pre-ordering needs. And after you do get your comics there and your mind is all blubberfied, be sure to send them an email and tell them that the two guys with PhDs sent you.
Yeah, maybe go there after you've taken your Silkwood shower, after you've... after you've read Blubber 2 through 4.
Yeah, I know that I'm going to have to take a shower after we do our episode for today.
Yeah.
But, you know, before we get to that, we do have other things that we want to share with listeners. The first of that being some listener feedback that we've received.
Yeah, let's hear some of this.
Mail time.
Ooh, the mail's here. That means we get to see our old friend Mailbox.
So we've gotten a few emails over the past several days, and let's read them because I think they're very enlightening, and also they make us feel good.
Okay.
We got one from Jason Martinez. Hey, Derek and Andy, new listener here. I really dig your show. I've been listening to iFanboy for years, but I've never been a huge fan of superhero books, so I'm glad to have discovered the Comics Alternative. I have no idea how long it's taken me so long. I just listened to the episode on crime comics and was shocked that no one mentioned Stray Bullets or Sin City. Perhaps my definition of crime genre is too broad. I also really enjoyed the first couple of years of Thief of Thieves, which I think has only recently started to lose its spark. What do you guys think of those titles? Jason Martinez. And at first I thought that maybe Jason was referring to the two-part crime episode that you and I did a few years ago. Mm-hmm. When I responded to him, though, to ask about that, he was actually listening to a recent episode. In fact, it was this month's On Location show at Valhalla Comics, where we talked about, among other things, some crime comics. And I think he's right. No one did bring up Stray Bullets or Sin City, although we were talking about very recent stuff. But Stray Bullets would have fit into that. But I told him that we're planning on doing more with crime comics in the very near future.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you're talking about, you know, the contemporary world of crime comics, Stray Bullets and Sin City are the two kind of key texts that seem to start the ball rolling with a resurgence in crime.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's something that not too long from now, you and I can discuss when we look at some recent crime titles. So thank you, Jason. I'm glad that you discovered the Comics Alternative and that you're a new listener.
Yeah, thanks.
And in fact, new listenership is the subject of another email that we got. This is from Kyler Roberts. She is actually an Ignatz winner for this year. She does the mini comic Powdered Milk, and I had the pleasure of meeting her at SPX and interviewing her. And in fact, that show went up a few days ago. It was fun. So she emailed me to say that it was great to meet you. You are the best comics podcaster I've heard. So you know why I wanted to share this.
Yeah.
She said, you really keep the pace moving along and everything seems natural and intentional. Thank you so much for including me. You have a new fan. Kyler Roberts.
That's great. I mean, Powdered Milk's been, you know, that's been around for a while, right? She's been doing that autobiographical series for some time.
Yeah. And one of the things that Gwen and I discussed on last week's show, we spent quite a bit of time talking about Powdered Milk. I mean, we did the whole show around this year's Ignatz nominees and winners. But one of the things that stands out to us with Powdered Milk is it's a different kind of autobiographical comic. It sometimes has a very leisurely feel to it where what happens in one scene or one installment isn't necessarily linked to the next. And I kind of like that because it's much more reflective, I feel, of the real lived experience.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. So I'm just starting to listen to that particular episode that you and Gwen did. But so I haven't gotten to the point where you've started talking about Powdered Milk.
So, yeah, I want to thank Kyler for that kind email. And third, we got an email from Wayne Hall. This is someone, Andy, that you and I met last year at HeroesCon. He says, Derek, I think I met you at HeroesCon last year. I continue to make my podcast. And by the way, his podcast is Wayne's Comics Podcast. And he said that he bought Carol Tyler's recent book, Soldier's Heart, at this year's Space Convention in Ohio. Sadly, I haven't had the chance to read it yet, but it will be I will be getting to it soon. I'd also like to interview her once I've read it. Nice job letting her do all the talking. Many hosts feel that they have to at least match the time their guest takes, which I don't buy. I'll keep an eye out for your podcast in the future, Wayne Hall. And you can find Wayne's podcast, All About Comics, at waynescomicspodcast.com. That's one word, waynescomicspodcast.com.
Yeah, any time that we can direct somebody to reading Soldier's Heart is a great accomplishment on our part.
Yeah.
Because that is a book that really everybody should read.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's so many autobiographical or memoir comics out there that even of those released in the past, let's say, year or two, that doesn't seem to get, I feel, as much attention as it should. And maybe because we saw kind of a different version of that with those first three volumes of You'll Never Know. And so by the time the entire collection came out last year, it was like, you know, we've seen something like this before, although that collection was different than in some ways, from the three earlier volumes.
Yeah, I like, though, that the collection exists because, you know, in thinking about, you know, possibly teaching that book, for example, though the Soldier's Heart is a pretty big book, at least it's, you know, it's all there in a single volume and you can you know, order it for a class versus, you know, the difficulty would be in ordering those three hardcover volumes of You'll Never Know.
Exactly. So, yeah, thanks to Wayne, Kyler, and Jason for your emails. We do like hearing from you guys. So, yeah, get in touch with us, send us emails, drop us a message on Twitter or Facebook. We just like to hear from you guys. Even if it's something criticizing us, we like to get those messages as well.
Sure.
Well, there's also some news that we should share with our listeners. you know, one recent bit since you and I have done a show together, Andy, is that our podcast is now carried on the Creative Disturbance Network. Now, the Creative Disturbance Network is housed out of my home university, University of Texas at Dallas. And in fact, if people want to check out Creative Disturbance, they can go to creativedisturbance.org. That's one word, Creative Disturbance. And the way that they describe Creative Disturbance is this way. It says, Creative Disturbance, this is from their website, Creative Disturbance is an international multilingual online platform that provides a unique virtual environment for the intellectually curious across the globe to meet, network, collaborate, create, and socialize. Here, new communities of thinkers are fostered and developed, and as a product of this linking, unlikely connections emerge. One means of both sharing and spurring such interactions is through a dynamic collection of podcasts outsourced and produced by Creative Disturbance members. And Andy, you and I are now Creative Disturbance members.
Oh, that's great. I like disturbing things.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is – I mean, I've known about Creative Disturbance. I didn't think that this – what we do, the Comics Alternative, would be something that they would want to include in their network. But this semester – someone got in touch with me and said, would you want to be a part of this? We said, sure. Now, not every one of our episodes is going to be going up on Creative Disturbance because we probably put out a little too many episodes and we would overwhelm things over there. But our weekly shows will definitely be going up there on Creative Disturbance.
Oh, good. Good.
So you can get our podcast there, but definitely check out Creative Disturbance to see what other kind of shows that they have. And in terms of subject matter, it varies widely, just as the language varies widely. Different podcasts in different languages dealing with different intellectual topics. So that's creativedisturbance.org.
Yeah, that's good. I'm curious to see what kind of feedback, if anything, we get from this, because you know most of the places where we're found are you know for people who are interested in comics podcasts, this is going to be a much broader net. So I wonder if we'll catch people who may not listen to comics podcasts regularly through this.
I hope so. Well, on the topic of comics podcasts, you and I were talking off mic about a new player in the field.
Yeah. So and it's interesting when you mention with the Creative Disturbance, how only our weekly shows will go up and so on. But because I'll get to why that's important in a minute. But Michigan State University, through one of the professors there, Ryan Clater, who's also a comics creator himself, and he teaches comics production classes. You can find his comics at elephanteater.com, and his autobiographical series was called And Then One Day. I got the chance to meet Ryan once, or a couple times actually, while I was at the Michigan State University comic art collection doing some research. And he and I, you know, had breakfast one day and we talked about autobiographical comics for a while. I was glad to see that he has, through Michigan State University, started the Michigan State University Comic Art and Graphic Novel Podcast. You can find it on iTunes, but also their website is msucomics.libsyn.com. And it's got one episode up so far, and it is an interview, includes an interview with Sergio Aragonés, which is a good get for your first interview.
That is.
The format of the show, which I find interesting, I think a lot of our listeners, especially those who are kind of more academically inclined, will also find interesting. So they have a segment in which Ryan talks to Randy Scott, who's the in charge of the special collections comics collection. And Randy brings out then one of the rare or interesting or important comics that they have in their collection. And so for this first episode, it's appropriate that he brings out the works of Rudolf Töpfler, which are considered to be the first comics.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and so they, then they'll talk about that and then they go into the interview. Now, this podcast is going to be monthly, during the academic year. So it'll be 9 episodes for the first season and all 9 episodes are already recorded. That seems like a really humane way to do a podcast.
Getting all that out or recorded and then pacing themselves.
One episode a month, 9 episodes in a year. What do you think about that, Derek?
So is this a kind of comment about my work habits?
You're the hardest working man in podcasting, Derek. But we, you know, even a multiple podcasts per week is at first when I heard that Ryan was doing it that way, I thought, what a slacker. But then I thought, you know what? I'd do that. That'd be nice. Yeah.
Well, you know, actually what we have now at the Comics Alternative is much more like a podcast network than just a single podcast. And we could do what we do. We could turn it into a podcast network and then house our different series, like, of course, the regular review show, but then there'd be the interview series, the Young Reader series, the manga series, Eurocomics, so on and so forth, under the network umbrella. Mm-hmm. The thing about that, though, is that if each of those series is a standalone podcast that's a part of a larger network, then that would cost more money because we would need to get individual accounts and feeds for each of those series. So, but you're right. We do a lot of episodes. This does sound like at Michigan State, a more humane way for everyone involved. And the official title of that podcast again is
Michigan State University Comic Art and Graphic Novel Podcast.
Wow.
I think if you just Google Michigan State University Comic Podcast, you'll find it pretty easily. But that first interview with Sergio is fantastic. They go deep into his life and his career. It's more kind of not focused really on a new work that's coming out, but more about his his biography and his major works.
We know that's really good because it's it would appeal to the kind of people who I think appreciate, at least I hope appreciate, mm-hmm. The Comics Alternative. But at the same time, it's doing something very different. I mean, yeah, we do a lot of interviews, but I think 99% of the time we tend to anchor our interviews or at least use a springboard new releases.
Right.
Whereas given the nature of the show, right, especially if they're recording all of this stuff ahead of time and mm-hmm. then releasing it one episode a month, you know, they're more interested in doing creator profiles that
exactly.
that wouldn't necessarily be linked to any new publication, which I think is great. It's doing something similar to what we do, but in a very different way. And it's kind of like other podcasts that I think would appeal to our listeners that maybe deal with, let's say, alternative comics, you know, the Indie Spinner Rack. Now, I think that's only an interview-based show. We do the interviews, but we also do the reviews. Mm-hmm. So having the Michigan State show doing profiles on a monthly basis, I think it's a valuable addition.
Yeah, it sure is. And then there was one other thing I wanted to mention before we get going here. Most of our listeners probably already know this, but last week, the MacArthur Foundation has announced its Genius Grants recipients, and one of our former guests, Jean Luen Yang, received one of those Genius Grants.
That's great news.
Yep. So that means that raises our count of MacArthur Grant recipients on who have been on this podcast to 2. Right?
Who was the other?
Ben Catcher.
Ben Catcher. Wow.
Because yeah. I think it's Ben Catcher, Gene Yang, and Alison Bechdel, I think, are the 3 cartoonists. There may be political cartoonists in there that I'm not remembering. Mm.
Had Ben on the show after he had received it, but
yes.
But Yang got his after appearing mm-hmm. on the Comics Alternative. So now, not immediately after, but
soon enough after to think that there was some influence there.
Right? Yeah, again, you know, the fabled comics alternative bump.
Right, exactly. Now for the MacArthur Foundation grants. Not just for the Eisners.
That's right. Now, you know, I saw that Gene Luen Yang is going to be in Dallas at a half-price bookstore doing a signing.
Great.
Next month. And so I hope I'm able to make it out there and have him sign some copies of my books. And if I do, I'll be sure to tell him congratulations and ask him to thank us.
Yeah. Unfortunately, other than having him on our podcast, I've never had a chance to actually meet him. I was supposed to meet him. I was supposed to actually go out to dinner with him.
Oh, wow.
And, because he was coming to Columbia, South Carolina for, an event at the University of South Carolina campus. And that happened to be to coincide with the massive 1,000-year flood that we had. And so his appearance was canceled as the campus and most of the state was shut down. So that was disappointing.
Well, Andy, you want to get into a discussion of this week's titles?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, we're going to begin with a book that I know you and I have had for a little while, but the official release, according to Amazon at least, when it became available to the buying public, was last week, September 20th. And this is The Lost Work of Will Eisner. This is published through Locust Moon Press. And in fact, we've talked about this book a few times in the past, alluding to it. It was kickstarted last year. Mm-hmm. But last year, we also did a Locust Moon Press publisher spotlight, and the episode went up right at the time, right around the week that the Kickstarter was ending. And in fact, when I did speak with the publisher, Josh O'Neill, for that publisher spotlight, we made it a point to mention something about the Kickstarter campaign. So we wanted to get that up like right before the Kickstarter ended. So this was kickstarted, but now it's also available through the press. So even if you weren't a part of the Kickstarter campaign, you can get the book.
Yeah, that's right. And so you and I both kickstarted it.
Mm-hmm.
Which did you just get the regular version, or did you get any of the special deals that they had?
No, I just I got the book. I didn't kick it up to where my name is mentioned in the back. Although I couldn't remember if I did that or not. I was looking at the 2-page thank you spread and scanned it a couple of times for my name and didn't see it. And then I was reminded, oh yeah, that's right. I didn't kick it up a bit.
Yeah, so I'm on there, and so is our fellow co-host Gene Cannenberg.
Right. The slacker of the three.
Well, no, I'm not saying this to make you feel bad. I just like seeing my name in print. But I also got mine has the book plate signed by Dennis Kitchen, and who does the introduction, and Joseph Getzinger, who's the man who found these strips, which we'll probably talk about in a bit. And then there's also a print in here of one of the strips that I guess I can hang on my wall or something suitable for framing.
Yeah. So now this is edited by the people at Locust Moon Press, Andrew Carl, Josh O'Neill, and Chris Stevens. And it, as you mentioned, it has an introduction by Dennis Kitchen. What better person to write an intro? Someone who knew Eisner very well, who was his publisher and publicist. Mm-hmm. So let's give a little context about this book, because mm-hmm. it is literally work that had been very early work from Will Eisner that had been lost.
Yes. Mm. So we get two series here, Harry Carey and Uncle Otto. Uncle Otto is a pretty straight pantomime humor strip, mm-hmm. With a gag every every strip. And then Harry Caray is a kind of odd adventure series that that shifts around, and I think points to it being an early work where Eisner's still finding his, you know, stylistic feet and so on. The lost part of it is a pretty amazing story that this this collector named Joseph Getzinger managed to find a little over 8,000 zinc printing plates containing comic strips from the 30s and later. And the fact that these even survive when those zinc plates were usually melted down, especially during World War II, that alone, that they survive, is amazing. And then that he, when going through them, discovered that there were these two series by Will Eisner, though Will Eisner uses a pseudonym with each, Carl Heck for Uncle Otto and Willis Renzi, which is Eisner spelled backwards.
Right.
And that's a pretty common pen name that Eisner used a lot.
Right.
Early in his career. So that would have been an easy one to figure out there. So these were discovered, and Locust Moon worked with Getzinger and the Eisner estate to put out this volume of these surviving strips.
Yeah, exactly. And these are the now earliest known strips, or the earliest known comics that Eisner had done.
Right. Eisner, as Dennis Kitchen's intro points out, Eisner had done Harry Caray while in high school,
right,
at DeWitt Clinton School, but it was a different version of the series then.
Right. We even have some samples of different versions of that high school attempt.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that surprised me about this book, and when we're talking about them as lost works and the earliest works, is they're not as early as I thought they would be. As Dennis Kitchen points out, these are probably around 1936 to 1939. So 36, Eisner is 19 years old, already partnering up with Jerry Iger to do the Eisner and Iger studio. If we go into 39, Eisner's already doing Jumbo Comics by then, and packaging other series, plus only about a year or two away from The Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Right. In fact, you mentioned Jumbo Comics. In Dennis Kitchen's introduction, there is a reproduction of the cover of Jumbo Comics number one, which features a strip of Uncle Otto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So fans of Will Eisner probably would have been able to see in some places some Uncle Otto and some Harry Caray material, but these strips themselves would have been difficult to find. According to Kitchen's introduction, the Eisner-Iger studio produced these strips and didn't really send them to the major newspapers in the country. Instead, they were sold fairly cheaply to small town newspapers.
Right, exactly. And one of the things that Dennis Kitchen speculates on is, let me finish the thought. He wonders if the story that we get, or the ending of, let's say, Harry Caray that we get, was the actual ending. And he suspects that it probably is. He says, but for all we know, there is more to this strip that weren't in the plates, and maybe a small paper somewhere, if they have collections, you know, the older newspapers collected somehow, that the story continues on a little further. But I think there's another thing he mentions, is there is one strip in the Harry Carey section of the book that they didn't have the plates for, but they had to reproduce from a newspaper archive.
Right, right. So I'm assuming then that a lot of these strips actually do survive as strips in newspaper archives somewhere.
Somewhere.
Yeah. And I know, you know, the Library of Congress has been working with local universities and libraries to digitize a lot of newspapers, especially trying to focus in on the small town newspapers in rural areas that might not be, you know, that there might be only one library in the country that has their stuff. And I know University of South Carolina's librarians were working on this for a long time. And so I met with one once and asked, you know, are there comic strips in these that you've never heard of? And they said, oh, yeah. And especially in some of the African-American newspapers. And I found that to be really kind of fascinating. Now, for these projects, the librarians also told me they tend to stop around 1926 because that's about the line where you can be confident that you're in fair use territory. Mm. After 1926, you start to have to, you know, look for copyright holders, especially for the comic strips and things like that.
Right. I would also guess that another really big challenge for something like this, right? I mean, these old Eisner strips and comics like them is that if they were primarily written for and marketed to these very small town, regional, rural newspapers, the likelihood of them surviving in any kind of archive are going to be greatly diminished because it's these small publications, right, these small presses that just did not have the financial wherewithal to preserve things in any way. And so they would need to scrap or recycle or whatever they would need to do to get rid of material to make room for new stuff or just going out of business, right? And there's, you know, no need, I would guess, that they would see to preserve anything. And again, they just wouldn't have the finances, the ability, the resources to save this stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I would be really curious to see, how these strips appeared in newspapers. Because, you know, one of the things we're talking about here is kind of the history, behind these strips and the discovery of them and so on. And to me, that's where the primary interest of this book lies, because in reading these strips, they're not great.
Yeah.
the gag strips, I often find really, really hard to figure out even what the gag is, or what's supposed to be funny about it. And in the Harry Carey kind of adventure series, as one of the things that Dennis Kitchen points out, it shifts in tone and style dramatically after about 8 strips, and becomes a completely different series that doesn't even feature the character Harry Carey anymore, but instead is focused in on a secret agent named ZX5. And Eisner's style changed. So I think for those listeners or readers who are Eisner fans, one of the main interests here would be to see kind of Eisner finding his style, because that stylistic shift from a really kind of cartoony and caricatured style for Harry Carey into what Dennis Kitchen describes as something closer to, say, what Alex Raymond was doing on Secret Agent X9 and so on.
Right.
Is really actually seeing where Eisner's style on the spirit starts to evolve as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk about these two storylines or these two strips, Uncle Otto and Harry Carey. I'm with you on the Uncle Otto not being able to determine where the gag was in some of these. I mean, I guess I can almost kind of force see
right.
where it is. I just don't think it's that funny. And one I see is an example that I come to. I just opened the book indiscriminately. This is on page 32. This is when Uncle Otto – and we should say that Uncle Otto seems to be – you mentioned a pantomime. This is a pantomime strip. And so that immediately calls to mind other famous pantomime strip like Carl Anderson's Henry, and then Otto Goslow's The Little King. In fact, Dennis Kitchen mentions that the shape of the character Uncle Otto is somewhat similar to the shape of Soglo's The Little King. And he's also wearing a hat. Uncle Otto is wearing a hat that's kind of tall that, you know, looks like the tin can that is worn by, who's the
Happy
character?
Hooligan.
Happy Hooligan, yes. Yeah. So, you know, this is probably someone that Eisner's creating from, you know, images of other comics at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the one that I was going to reference, Uncle Otto is looking at this sign that says, "Eat oranges for health." And then he passes another sign that says, "An apple a day keeps the doctor away." And then he passes another sign that says, "Strong men eat pears." And then in the last panel, we see Uncle Otto eating a banana.
Right. And so the punchline is he's eating a banana instead of eating these other three fruits. That feels to me, and I don't mean to disparage Will Eisner, though. Some people have accused me of that being my very goal in life. But that feels like the kind of joke that like a 3 or 4 year old makes,
right,
who understands the structure of a joke, but doesn't understand actually how the component parts of that joke should function in terms of being funny. So, you know, if you ever do it like a knock knock joke with a 4 year old and have them invent their own knock knock joke, you kind of get it. They understand that there are these components to that joke, but nothing about the punchline is funny.
Right. Now, another one that I think does have more of a discernible and effective punchline, this is on page 28, and there's a reason why I'm bringing this one up in particular, mm-hmm. but I do think it's a better joke. This is one where Uncle Otto is on a park bench, and he's trying to read a newspaper, and a guy comes up to him and says, "Where's Watt Street?" And then Otto points in the direction. And then in the next panel, a second guy comes up and asks Uncle Otto, "How far is Seamus Park from here?" And then in the third panel, a woman comes up and says, "Could you please direct me to, what is it, Bailey Boulevard?" And all this time, he's trying to read a newspaper. So in this last panel, we see him reading a newspaper, and he's wearing this placard that says, "I'm a stranger in town myself."
Yeah.
So he wants to be left alone.
It almost looks like a sandwich board.
Or, I'm sorry, yeah, it's a sandwich board, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought that strip up, because I don't know if you noticed the strip on page 39.
Oh, that's another reason I brought up that strip.
Okay, go ahead.
Because, yeah, on 39 we have something very similar going on, where he – I mean, the visuals – except for that last panel, are exactly the same with a little variation. So we have these three people coming up to Uncle Otto asking him for directions to something. Now, in this strip on page 39, they're asking him different things. Everybody's asking where the Royal Theater is. And they're the first guy, the second guy, and then the woman. And what Eisner does, at least with the first guy and with the woman, he draws them slightly differently. So the first guy who comes up in the asking for directions in that earlier strip that I mentioned doesn't have a mustache, but he has one in the strip where he's asking for the directions to the Royal Theater. Same thing with the woman. In the strip where the woman's asking for directions to Bailey Boulevard, she's wearing glasses. She's not wearing glasses. Mm-hmm. In when she's asking directions to the Royal Theater. But in the first three panels, outside of those slight variations, the illustrations are the exact same, except for that last panel, which is a different gag. Which I that's one of these that I'm wondering, where's the gag? I don't get it as much because they're in the theater and he's there as well with a big question mark over his head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And the middle panel, the only real difference there is the guy's hat's different.
Yeah.
It looks to me like I'd like to hold those first three panels of each of those like up to a light or something and see, because I get the sense that those panels are just retraced or even just duplicated with slight redrawings.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're retreads. And you know, this is something that I think it was Dennis Kitchen that even points out, that some of these strips with both the Uncle Otto and the Harry Carey, they vary in quality. And, mm-hmm. you know, this could speak to the fact that at certain times, you know, given the shop, the Eisner Iger mm-hmm. shop, that maybe Eisner didn't have as much time to work on these himself and so gave them to someone else to do, right? So they're mm-hmm. just recycling some of the work. But another reason could be that Eisner is doing them himself, but in order to take shortcuts because of time restraints and workload, that he is literally recycling and just tweaking ever so slightly certain images, earlier art that he's created.
Yeah, that seems to – I mean, it would be interesting to do a closer comparison, because I know, for example, I first noticed this repetition of images on page 38 with the strip at the top. But what made that one interesting was that it's four panels, and I think three of the panels contain elements that are used in – three different strips.
Right.
So there may be a lot more recycling done than we may even know. Mm-hmm. And especially even with the Uncle Otto character himself. This is basically what Jim Davis does today with Garfield. Right. I mean, he's drawn Garfield in every possible facial expression and position. And you just like somebody, maybe not even Jim Davis anymore, though Andy Hirsch may know more about this than we do, just kind of does color forms or whatever mm-hmm. and moves the elements around in a strip. So I never thought about that issue of, you know, the time constraints, especially Eisner being incredibly overworked at this time, putting out a lot of this product on his own.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, and there's, you know, not just the recycling of certain images and positions of Otto and some of the other people here, but there are also visual repetitions, certain icons that are used over and over again.
Right.
For instance, one that keeps cropping up, and this is also on page 38, the heart, the two hearts with the arrow going through it, right?
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of those. In fact, we have two instances of that. One where Otto is, talking with her on his knees with a woman, and then another strip where a dog is licking the face of Otto and is thinking of those hearts. And in fact, those two strips on page 38 strike me as the one instance in the Uncle Otto section of this book where there's some kind of continuity. What happens in that second strip on 38 could easily have picked up from where we leave off on that top strip. On the same page.
You know, take a look at the strip at the top of page 39.
Yeah, and you also
have the same conclusion.
Right. Now, and so we do have like a repetition of images and situation and even figures like the dog. Now, this leads me to another question. We don't get this as much with Harry Carey, or the question doesn't come up as much with Harry Carey, although I do have a question about ordering of these strips in the Harry Carey part. But with Uncle Otto, you could just mix and match these in any way whatsoever, and it would make sense as much as it could, right?
Right.
Now, I'm wondering, the editors of this collection, were they able to determine from the Getziger find a particular order in which these strips were created? And if so, did they present the strips in a chronological ordering? I get the sense that they didn't, because I mean, maybe I'm wrong here, but sometimes there's certain groupings of strips that thematically or based on certain images seem to have something in common. Mm-hmm. And so maybe they use that as a cue as to how to organize the Uncle Otto strips, or maybe that's the way that Eisner drew these, chronologically speaking, right? That he would do a series of strips with the hearts with the arrow through it and the dog, and then another series of strips with another visual motif. But I don't know. I mean, not that we necessarily need any kind of rationale for the ordering of the Uncle Otto strips, but I wonder if there was a rationale with the editors when they pulled this stuff together.
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, because I was thinking about that in relationship to the two strips about people being lost and Uncle Otto giving them directions that are, you know, identical except for the third page. It would look like to me that it's entirely possible that the theater one comes before the I'm a Stranger in Town Myself, that the one on 39 could have been made before. And one of the main reasons I say that is because the lines seem a little heavier, but that could just be an issue with the printing.
Right.
But the woman's glasses probably would have been easier to draw on.
That's true. That's true. Good point.
Later. But the thing that makes me question that theory is that the first version of that joke works so much better than the second version of that joke. So unless the second version is like a first draft that failed, it really feels like to me what the second version is an attempt to retread that joke that doesn't quite work as well as the earlier version. But I don't know.
Yeah, it would be interesting to know the order that they were created by Eisner, mm-hmm. but I mean, maybe yeah. That's something that we can't know.
Yeah, because I do think, as you mentioned before, and maybe this is the place to transition to Harry Carey, that there is at least one strip that's out of place in the Harry Carey.
Right, that's the one on page 63.
Let me look. Yes.
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 And at first I didn't notice it, but then on page 63, at this point in the story, at this point we no longer have the character Harry Carey, but Agent ZX5 and the doctor who has attended to him are being held in a room, and the doctor gets out of the room while Agent ZX5 is barricading the door with a chair. And so the doctor flags down a car that is passing down a road. And then at the end of this strip, the henchman, I think there's Alexis and the chauffeur is there, Alexei and the chauffeur. And Alexei, or the chauffeur says to Alexei, and these are the henchmen, "Hey, Alexei, those guys in there have been awful quiet. It looks kind of fishy," misspelled. And then Alexei says, "That, as you put it in your crude way, is fishy," misspelled. "We'll investigate." Now, after that, there are two or three strips later where the doctor's back in the room
right.
with the agent. It's like, what's he doing back there? Didn't he go get help? And so basically, that strip that we had just mentioned where the doctor does flag down a car should have gone right after the strip on the bottom of page 65.
Right, because the doctor heads out the window then and escapes.
Right, and then on 66, that next strip, we have the chauffeur and Alexei basically saying, "Well, what are those guys doing in there?" And so we know from the very end of that previous strip that we mentioned on 63, they're wondering, "What are those guys up to?" And right. So this strip kind of picks up where that one left off. Other than that, though, I think that everything seems to be in order. I didn't notice any other temporal anomalies.
No, but you know, when you started to try to explain where in the plot this scene took place, I thought, oh my God, we may end up being here forever. And Kitchen even talks about that in the introduction, where he tries to summarize the plot of Harry Carey. Just the ZX5 section. And
it's wild.
It's wild, it's really convoluted. There are plot shifts and kind of crazy inconsistencies. And he even seems to say that there the or he says that there seems to be no kind of outline that this plot is following, that Eisner and maybe whoever else he was working with on this were just kind of making things up as they went along. Mm-hmm. And so then the fact that it ends on a cliffhanger is also kind of a part of that kind of the reckless pace that these strips have.
Right. So, you know, as Kitchen speculates that maybe the last strip is the definite end of this story, mm-hmm. of this series, would make sense, because at this point, if they are, so to speak, kind of just making things up as they go along, then it doesn't matter where you end, right? Because there's never going to be an end point.
Yeah, exactly. And there never was an end plotted out to begin with. but, you know, he does point out two things as inconsistencies that I didn't really think were. One, he mentions that...
Who, Kitchen?
Yeah, mm-hmm. that he mentions that after ZX5 gets stabbed in the back, he does recover quite remarkably from that. That's true.
Right.
but that he suddenly appears much later on with a sling, his arm in a sling. However, it seems to me like his arm is in the sling immediately after the doctor treats him.
Right.
It's just maybe hard to see. Now, it does switch arms throughout. If you look carefully, sometimes it's on his right arm, sometimes it's on his left arm. And Kitchen also says the doctor seems to do a remarkable job of performing surgery on ZX5 with just hot water and towels. But we do see the doctor arrive with his doctor kit. So right. we might assume that there is enough stuff to seal up a knife wound to the back.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. I noticed that having ZX5's arm in a sling soon after the doctor treats him. Yeah, I mean, that seemed to be apparent. But I would just question the whole thing. Why is he was stabbed in the back, so why is his arm in a sling? Now, maybe he was hit in the shoulder to where a sling would hold it to such a point that it would help the healing process. But who knows? I'm no doctor.
Yeah, and apparently neither is Will Eisner. But, you know, it's interesting to – what's interesting about this whole book, and I think the ZX5 stuff is probably the most interesting
right.
for his kind of wild and inconsistent – it is the seeds of the spirit are there. You know, we see the kind of dashing hero. He even wears a domino mask at a masquerade ball, and Kitchen points out that being a kind of precursor to the spirit. But also the kind of dominant femme fatale who's actually running the criminal organization. Look at how many times the spirit runs up against that kind of
right.
A villain. And so so we really do see Eisner not just working out his visual style, which I think is really important, but also working out some of the elements that are going to become important parts of the spirit, that once they get to the spirit, they're working.
Right.
Whereas they're not quite there yet.
Exactly. And, you know, if we just stick with the spirit, I mean, you can look at the very early spirit strips and compare them to what comes, I mean, not too long after. And there's definitely noticeable difference in style.
Mm-hmm.
And so those very early spirit strips are, descendants from second mm-hmm. cousins to or something, these Harry Caray strips, or at least after we get out of the comedic Harry Caray with the character Harry mm-hmm. Caray. So stylistically, I do see that connection. And thematically, you know, you pointed out the femme fatale and the intrigue and the adventure here and the action that's going on. Although I do have to say that I don't know if it was Kitchen who wrote this or Richard Green, who does a short bit on the Getziger find. One of them mentions that you can't look at this governor's ball, right, the mask ball, and see ZX5 in a domino mask without thinking of Denny Colt and the spirit.
All right.
Well, I could. I mean, really, I looked at him, and he looks like a character in a domino mask. But then other characters are in domino masks. This is a ball, after all. So I don't know if visually, or at least I don't see as strong of a tie visually between ZX5 with a domino mask and Denny Colt with a domino mask. But the kind of links that you had mentioned, the thematic ones, the kind of adventure we have, and the kind of characters in Harry Carey that have similarities to Spirit, that's definitely there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one other thing that I would want to mention then along those lines of characters that are similar to or even precursors to the Spirit is that in the first eight strips with the actual character Harry Carey, he teams up with a young African American boy named 8-Ball. 8-Ball, interestingly, being, you know, the racially caricatured sidekick of Captain Marvel. This 8-Ball here is definitely a precursor to Ebony White. And in fact, I don't know.
8-Ball and the fortune teller.
8-Ball and the fortune teller. Yeah. You know, and, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I mean, 8-Ball makes Ebony White look tame,
right?
In comparison, not just in terms of the visual style, but also in terms of the jokes that 8-Ball is involved with are horrible,
right?
That's another thing. That's another characteristic of the Spirit, not just the Ebony White as racial caricature, but how Eisner mixed the realistic and the caricatured throughout that series. Mm-hmm. And so Harry Carey also then, even though it shifts into a more realistic style, more Alex Raymond influenced style with the ZX5 story, Eisner would continue to use that mixture throughout his career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these stereotypes that we get in the figures of 8-Ball and the fortune teller, and both of them are on page 46. They are egregious, and thankfully they're only in two strips, right? But boy, what's packed into those two strips in terms of African American stereotypes it is disturbing. I mean, the first time we see 8-Ball, he's coming out of what is this little shack, a chicken shack, and the first words out of his mouth. Who dat saying who dat every time I say who dat? And of course, you know, that is something that goes back to the kind of blackface caricature that you would find in vaudeville. You hear it in songs. You hear references to that every now and again. And so, I mean, this is something that a very young Will Eisner, very inexperienced, very insensitive, is just milking the stuff that are a part of the time then, and not just visually. But yeah, you're right. There's if you can get over the images and the way that these characters are represented on page 46, then you can enjoy as best you can the Harry Carey strip. But the other thing worth noting, and you've alluded to it already, is this abrupt shift, and this is actually takes place in the strip on that next page on 47, where we go from this almost comedic take of crime espionage comics into something more Alex Raymond like, right? Something much more serious. Mm-hmm. Where literally this shift is in the same strip divided in half. So in this first half of the strip on top of page 47, you have the character Harry Carey talking to, some official, and the official is telling him that he is being ordered to another territory. Because Harry Carey answers the phone and says, "Yes, sir, this is Harry Carey." And this other guy, whoever he is, this official, says, "Very good. This office hereby orders a change in your territory. You are now commissioned as American military attaché to Chesterland. Prepare to leave immediately." Well, if you're taking Harry Carey the strip seriously, it's like, well, this guy is working for some kind of organization where he can be moved as an American military attaché. And who is this other guy that he's talking to? But then in the second half of that strip, we're introduced to ZX5. And there is a transition there because the text in between the two halves of this strip says, and at the same time, across thousands of miles of sea and land, deep in the country of Chesterland, our attention centers on the beginning of a dramatic intrigue, a little room in an old boarding house. And from that point forward, Harry Carey as a character is nowhere to be seen.
Right, right. Even though the series still continues to be titled Harry Carey, yeah, it's not about him. But, you know, I want to say one more thing about 8-Ball before moving too far away from that. And that is, you know, you mentioned something that is also something that Dennis Kitchen mentions, that this can be kind of chalked up to the, inexperience of youth. And the a product of its time, and so on. But you know, I think this. I also think those two strips, or three strips, really, because 8-Ball shows up earlier, though he's inside the chicken coop, is indicative of, I think, a more kind of consistent attitude that Eisner has throughout his, mm-hmm. Throughout, especially the early part of his career. I mean, there is a straight line between 8-Ball and the first appearance of Ebony.
Right.
Some argue that Ebony becomes a much more rounded character and so on. But my attitude towards that has always been kind of, so what? If Eisner had been serious about changing Ebony, he would have changed Ebony's appearance.
Right,
not just his personality. So, so the idea that a racial character like that would have come to Eisner as a part of an earlier strip and then get recycled in the later strip seems to indicate that that's something that he wanted to include in that form.
Right. And that's a good point to make. Yeah. Yeah. I don't excuse this. I think mm-hmm. that Dennis Kitchen in his introduction did that a little bit and then moved on. I do think, though, that if you're looking at the body of Eisner's work, or especially mm-hmm. early in his career, right, focusing specifically on the spirit and the problems of Ebony White, then you can't ignore this.
Yeah.
So, that the shift in tone, and then the editorial glitch, I guess, in the chronological arrangement of these strips, I think are the most notable parts of the Harry Carey section of this book. But again, I think the Harry Carey has much more potential for discussion, as we've seen, than Uncle Otto. Uncle Otto, yeah, it's interesting. It's a curiosity more than anything, but. There's more to sink our teeth into when it comes to Harry Carey.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it points to some, a larger, it provides evidence for a larger understanding of Eisner as someone. And I think it goes back to, something Gary Groth said about Will Eisner and, one of the interviews he did with Eisner, that there's this constant tension between art and commerce mm-hmm. throughout Eisner's career. And one of the ways that tension plays out is in these early strips where Eisner is trying to basically duplicate the success of other strips, mm-hmm. Little King
and
Henry, and Henry always disturbed the hell out of me. yeah. He doesn't have a mouth.
The lack of mouth. Yeah.
and then also, that kind of developing a style out of Alex Raymond. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, we see creators do that all the time, you know, trying to kind of find their footing and what they want to do. But I think it's interesting to me how much, you know, what we see here is a kind of not so much a missing link, but that early development there of something that Eisner would continue to do later on, which is pull disparate elements from different influences to try to create something that was both financially and artistically successful. These seem to be primarily motivated by, commerce more so than art.
Right. You know, as the Eisner and Iger studio was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you want to move on to the next title that we're discussing this week?
Yes.
And that is Libby's Dad. This is by Eleanor Davis and published by Retrofit Big Planet Comics. I always like discussing Retrofit and Big Planet material because I love the way that they package their comics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, plus they fill a nice niche for I think especially for creators to be able to do these kind of short form works that are, you know, they're different from a mini comic, but they're not a graphic novel.
Oh yeah, definitely. They're not. And, I mean, this is the kind of story, Libby's Dad, that you find in, you know, most things coming out from Retrofit Big Planet. I mean, they do longer books and collections, as well, but I think a lot of the things that they do are these short story comics, I guess you could call them. Now, this short story, Libby's Dad, is something that you could easily have found in the collection of hers that came out a couple of years ago, How to Be Happy.
Right.
And that was published by Fantagraphics. But I guess this is the kind of stuff that she will do, and then I would hope that we would see Libby's Dad in another collection on down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think for listeners, I don't know what to say about summarizing the plot of Libby's Dad. It's a bunch of teenage girls are having a party at their friend Libby's house. And Libby's parents have recently gotten divorced. And Libby's mom has made the claim that Libby's dad is going to shoot her with his gun, and so the girls are anxious about the possibility of themselves getting killed by Libby's dad. Is that about it?
Yeah, that's it. So we do have this pool party at Libby's place, and there are five teenage girls. Although there's one member of their gang, someone by the name of Taylor, who didn't come, and that's what introduces mystery, if you want to call it that, that's associated with the title, Libby's Dad, because as the girls are talking, and this thing is narrated by one of the girls, someone whose name is Alex.
Right.
And so Alex tells us that in her conversations with some of her other friends, usually when Libby is away and can't hear the conversation, that the reason why Taylor is not there is because Taylor's mom had heard that Libby's mother said that, you know, Libby's father wanted to shoot her. And so that's what causes this intrigue among the teenage girls. Now, this is just hearsay, right? Mm-hmm. And to call it intrigue is, you know, probably overstating it. But within the context of, you know, these young girls, it is intrigue, right? And one of the things I love about this story, this short story, is that Eleanor Davis is able to get into the mind of these young girls and to treat this as a very serious situation, right? I mean, she's definitely in no way she's not mocking the girls and accusing them in even some gentle way of hyperbole, because this is serious for them. The way that they're trying to make sense of Libby's dad, you know, does he or doesn't he have a gun, and will he or won't he shoot not only Libby's mother, but also maybe us? And then also later at the very end, they start speculating about Libby's mother. Maybe she's the one who's mm-hmm. not right. Now, all of this comes to a head in the evening when a few of them, I guess one in particular, is painting her toenails. Mm. And the bottle of nail polish falls over, and, of course, it's red. And it stains the carpet. And, of course, you know, there's the violence, the image of violence there in blood. And the girls freak out. They think that Libby's father is going to be really, really angry that they spilled nail polish on the carpet, that he's going to get his gun out and shoot them. But they learn that once the father finds out, all that he does is come into the room with some kind of stinky solvent stuff, as she describes it, and wipes up the mess in a very friendly way.
Yeah, so I think that what you're pointing out there with that summary is that the story feels almost kind of ephemeral, mm-hmm. but in a good way,
right.
You know, that you're dealing with a very small incident within the lives of some teenage girls. I like how you pointed out that she's not judging these girls or anything like that, And it feels real. It's just a little slice of life, and I really enjoyed that aspect of it. I think it's also an exercise for Davis, an artistic exercise for Davis, because one of the things we haven't mentioned is the visual style, which seems, I believe, is colored pencils.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, and even the lettering is in. Isn't a regular number two pencil or whatever.
It looks like something you could take an eraser to and it'll easily come off.
Exactly. And that, I think, adds to its ephemeral mm-hmm. nature. Plus the fact that Davis, and this is fairly common in her work, doesn't use panel borders.
Right.
And so everything just kind of floats together. It is really, so on top of being, you know, this very nice light story, it's a beautiful book as well.
It is. And, you know, as we pointed out, there doesn't seem to be, at least on the surface, to be much about this to this story. And so if someone would ask me, you know, well, what is this about? It's not really about anything. I'd say, oh, contraire. You know, I mean, it is about something. It's about, you know, the way young people think. And I think that is the challenge there for Davis to get in mm-hmm. to her characters here, specifically her narrator, Alex. And the things that they discuss, the suppositions that they have, and then the conclusions that they come to at the end of the book, I think, about both the father and the mother of Libby are very typical of the way that children think.
Yes.
You know, not that I can remember the way that I thought when I was that age, but I imagine I thought the same way, that the things that these girls are talking about in terms of speculating about Libby's father, you know, ooh, is he going to shoot us? I mean, those are the kind of – those are the ways that I thought, and I talked with my friends at mm-hmm. the time, I'm sure.
And those fantasies gain traction because of the kind of echo chamber within the group of friends.
Mm-hmm. And exactly.
You know, so they all start kind of buying into this fantasy about Libby's dad, and that makes it seem all the more real to them, to the point that they're actually visualizing themselves getting shot in the head.
Yeah. And in fact, I'm glad that you mentioned that section. This is toward the end of the book, and this is a two-page spread where Alex is saying, we thought Libby's dad was going to shoot her right in the head, and then he was going to come shoot us. And you do see, I mean, this is very graphic. For this to be, that at first it caught me by surprise, because for this to deal with such an innocent subject matter, right, you know, a sleepover, young girl sleeping over, and then to have them being shot in the head, I mean, you do see them shot in the head, and you see the red blood spurting out. Of course, the red, the same color as the nail polish that they spill. That is quite jarring. But that is one of the two sections of this story that we're taken out of the reality of the moment, because that's a fantasy that those girls have, right? They think that there's a possibility they're going to get shot. But there's an earlier one-page departure from the story, and this is right after the nail polish was spilled. And it is an image, kind of a silhouette, really, of a gun. of a handgun. Mm-hmm. What did you think of that when you saw that?
I thought that was interesting because that kind of jarred me for a moment, mm-hmm. you know, because that where is that image in the diegesis?
Right.
You know, it's not, is it a kind of fantasy, you know, is it part of the what the girls are visualizing is going to happen, or is it meant on Davis's part to be a kind of non-diegetic insert that is meant to have us, you know, meant to represent the fear the girls have. But also that image itself, it looks to me like what Davis has done, for those who are listening, it's a drawing of a gun, but the gun is in the white space on a page that is otherwise covered in the blue pencil or crayon that she's using here. So
like a reverse silhouette.
Yeah, like a reverse silhouette. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And also notice the direction that gun is pointing, right? Of the two-page spread that this is a part of, this is on the right-hand side or the left-hand side, and it's pointing toward the right-hand page, and that's where the girls are panicking now because they've spilled the nail polish. And so it's pointing right at them.
Right.
That's a great question that you raised. Is this a fantasy moment? Is this something that they're imagining? So is this an image that's representative of what's going on in their heads right now? Or is this a non-diegetic insert from the author, Eleanor Davis herself, mm-hmm. that kind of a momentary intrusion into the story in a way that has us thinking in a manner that we wouldn't without that? For instance,
right.
You know, that the violence of this moment may be kind of fantastical to a point. On the other hand, I mean, all you have to do is turn on the news, and we see things like this happening all the time, unfortunately.
Right.
So this is a really good story. You know, Eleanor Davis was at SPX
mm-hmm.
last weekend. I did not have the opportunity to meet her. I saw her from a distance, but I had forgotten to take my copy of Libby's Dad, so I couldn't have gotten mm-hmm. her to sign this anyhow. I wish I had, though.
Yeah.
But this is definitely worth checking out. And this was just released, I believe it was last week, from Retrofit Big Planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't counted the number of times that you and I have talked about Retrofit Big Planet comics, but it's a lot. And I think that everything they do is definitely worth checking out. I mean, they're I have to tell you, one of my favorite publishers right now, especially one of my favorite very small presses.
Well, yeah, and they're getting, you know, I mean, Eleanor Davis is at the, you know, top of the alternative comics world, you know,
mm-hmm.
And they get, you know, they get solid creators and, you know, creators I've never seen before. And I like that mix. But also I think that they're giving them an opportunity to publish certain kinds of works that you wouldn't find from other publishers that are, you know, like you mentioned, the shorter works that then later we can imagine a bigger Eleanor Davis collection in which Libby's Dad is included.
Right. You know, even Box Brown, who does work in the past and coming up with First Second, mm-hmm. you know, he's one of the publishers here, and he's done work with, his own label. So I think it's really good that that the creators that they publish do stuff with them, but then also for larger presses like First, Second, and Fantagraphics.
Yep.
Well, on the topic of Fantagraphics, let's get to the third title that we are discussing this week, and this is Gilbert Hernandez's Blubber, issue number 3.
I almost kind of wish we had done this before Libby's Dad and used Libby's Dad as a kind of palate cleanser.
Well, that's a good Blubber. That's a good point.
But I like talking about Blubber. I know this is a third issue, and we don't normally do third issues, but I would like to actually talk about every issue of Blubber as it comes out.
And we're big fans of Gilbert Hernandez.
Yeah, of course. And I think that this more than other works, other issues of Blubber, focuses a lot on different characters masturbating. It seems like in every picture, somebody's holding their penis.
Right. There's more penis holding in this issue than the previous issues of Blubber.
Which is saying a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think Blubber number two probably had the record.
Right.
For that before this.
Now, earlier you mentioned Blubber number two. Earlier this year, I think it was back in April, you and I did a show where we focused all on the Hernandez brothers,
right. But
mostly Gilbert because they had several things coming out at that time. And it was at that point on that episode, and I can't remember the episode number, that we discussed Blubber number two, although we referenced number one. Now, we haven't officially discussed Blubber number one on our weekly review show, but I think last year, at some point, you and I discussed Blubber number one on one of our Patreon supplemental shows that only certain levels of Patreon supporters get.
That could very well be. I know I remember talking about it with you.
Yeah.
So one of the first things that we see in Blubber number three is on the inside front cover. And by the way, so Gilbert uses the full comic. Here, there is nothing wasted
right. In
this comic, and the inside in every issue so far, the inside covers as well. But I feel like the Mr. Elvis strip that starts this book off is almost a kind of Blubber manifesto.
It is in many ways. Yeah, I like the way you put that.
Because Mr. Elvis is basically a masturbating satyr, and somebody off kind of off screen is asking him questions, but one of the panels asks, "What do you say today, Mr. Elvis?" And he says, "Let freedom ring." And then asks, "And what else?" "That's all. I could say that," the voice says. And Mr. Elvis says, "Then say it often to everyone you meet." "Thanks, I will. Let freedom ring. They call me Mr. Elvis."
As he's masturbating,
as he's orgasming. And so but the idea of like kind of let freedom ring. I mean, I think that if anything, Blubber is its mission statement is that this is going to just kind of be unleashing free creativity in all these wild ways, and just accept that.
Right.
And not only accept, but the kind of let freedom ring being this kind of patriotic slogan as well, is that this is America. This is free. Yeah. You know, this is free speech at work.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, you know, with Blubber, we have the closest that not only that Gilbert Hernandez, but I think that any of the creators that we tend to lump together as, you know, alternative comics creators come to the underground comics, right, of the 1960s and 70s. Now, if you are familiar with the work of Gilbert Hernandez, but you haven't yet had the pleasure, if we want to put it that way, of encountering Blubber, this is different. I mean, if you read some of his Love and Rockets material, specifically the Fritz stories, even if you read Birdland, you're not going to be prepared for the kind of storytelling, if we want to call it storytelling, that we get in the Blubber series. I mean, this is Gilbert, to say it, letting it all hang out is maybe putting it lightly. I mean, he is just having fun. He's doing, it seems, very stream of consciousness, stream of artistic inspiration. These don't seem to have, I mean, they're not solid stories, right? If you're looking for good storytelling, don't look here. Look for Love and Rockets. You basically have situation scenario leading to situation scenario leading to situation scenario. And what all of these situation scenarios have in common, almost in every story in Blubber, is erection, fucking, masturbation, you name it. I mean, there's just so much fucking sucking. there's a lot of oozing in this issue.
Yeah.
More than the others.
It is a liquidy issue. And the bulk of the issue is a pretty long silent story, which is just a matter of a bunch of various creatures giving each other oral and or anal sex and then killing each other until we finally end up with one surviving character who's a satyr.
Circle of Life is the name of
the book. Circle of Life. But I wanted to mention something about Blubberoo, the first story that follows Mr. Elvis, because this is the kind of the main reason I wanted to talk about this book in the first place. So we're introduced to a character called Blubberoo. I'm guessing that's his name. I don't even want to begin to try to describe what he looks like. It's really hard. It would be impossible. He is more closer to humanoid, I guess, than a lot of the other characters in this book. But he's kind of frowning and crying, but he's saying, "Hugh, I have a good life. Hugh, see what I can do. See how free I am. So free." And he's running around. All he has on is a pair of socks, and he's masturbating. But then the next page, where we get what I think was one of the more interesting things that Gilbert's doing in this book, we cut to a cartoonist who's drawing the page that we just, or drawing a page with Blubberoo, and he's laughing and he says, "Har har, what a kind and thoughtful cartoonist I am. I can give him all the pleasure I want to. Today, I will give him more joy than ever. Har, har." And then he draws a picture of Blubberoo with a penis in his mouth, his anus, his eye socket, and he's also then masturbating as well. So, and then ha, 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 he loves it. Oh, he does love it so. And so then, and then something bad happens to him. And then we get, another kind of layer of the narrative here where, this other creature that's kind of like a fat bunny rabbit, is watching the cartoonist on television. And then he goes and he's in the room where Blubberoo's laying on the bed masturbating. And he tells Blubberoo about the cartoonist and what's happening to him. And so I don't know how to even describe it. It's like a kind of Escher-esque narrative where one layer is, where do all these kind of layers of the narrative go? If the creator of Blubberoo is being watched by Blubberoo's friend, who then tells Blubberoo what his creator is doing.
Right. Yeah. And you mentioned it like an Escher painting, and I think that makes sense. I was thinking of it as, let's say, a narrative Möbius strip, right?
Yeah.
It kind
of
bends around on itself, because when we see Blubberoo at the end, when this, big bunny creature is talking with Blubberoo, at first I thought that maybe this bunny creature was in that next level of the narrative, also a creator of some sort. And so what happens to the cartoonist as he's laughing is the result of what this bunny creature had willed. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't seem to be the case. But yet he's watching this from a distance. Yeah, it does look like a TV screen or a computer screen. Mm-hmm. But then he can report back to Blubberoo, who's now a part of this narrative level, which doesn't make sense. But then again, if you're looking at anything narrative-wise making sense in any Blubber story, you're in trouble.
that's right.
Yeah.
But
I'm with you, though. I think that this one really stood out. I think in addition to Mr. Elvis, which is, for my money, my favorite of this issue, Blubberoo is one of the most interesting just because of what it – I mean, this is – more than in the other issues, Gilbert commenting, again along with Mr. Elvis, about what he's doing here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this stood out to me, too, because I've recently been reading, as I'm working on doing some research on this Golden Age series that Quality Comics published called Inky. And Inky is a series that takes place within the Quality Comics offices, where it features cartoonists like Jack Cole and Milt Stein and Al Stahl and others, as they're creating the Inky series. You know, their boss comes in the first story and tells them that we need a new character, and nobody can kind of come up with something that quite works. And Inky himself, Al Stahl is given the final task of creating Inky, and he does it and falls asleep, and Inky pops off the page and finishes his own story. And then from then on, for a while in the series, Inky interacts with his creators all the time. And so this felt to me like the kind of pornographic extension of that. But the idea of the creator kind of the comic creator kind of being responsible for the happiness of his creation, I think is an interesting idea that's handled much more tamely in Inky than it is here,
right?
In this comic, it's a different kind of happiness, definitely, that Gilbert's creating for Blubberoo.
Yeah, I mean that's a great connection, a great observation. Now, you know, I remember when we were discussing back in the spring, Blubber number 2, there was one story that stood out to us, and that was Tamper. And the way I said it, that's the way that the name is spelled, because there are a lot of R's at the end. And the reason that story stood out in issue number 2, it was the one story where you didn't see anything explicit sexually speaking, at
right,
least. Right. I mean, there was violence, but you didn't get the same kind. You didn't get the, you know, violence or otherwise regarding sex, which you have in every other story in Blubber. And I was wondering if we'd get something similar to that in issue number 3. And mm-hmm. we don't, although the closest thing to this is The Snowman Cometh. And this is what, I guess, the cover image refers to. And so you have the snowman, who is a wrestler, who is in the wrestling ring, and he's defeated by an opponent, and he's shoved out for being washed up, right? So he can mm-hmm. no longer be a wrestler. And I thought, okay, so this is one where we won't have explicit sex. And granted, we don't have as explicit the sex scenes as we do in some of the other stories, but it's still here in this. But I think one of the things that stands out about this is defecation, because a characteristic that marks Snowman is that he can't help but defecate himself no matter where he is.
Yeah, yeah. And he's wearing, you know, spandex wrestling shorts. So we get, Gilbert gives us close-ups of his butt going blorp and, you know, chunks forming inside the spandex.
That's a memorable sound effect.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, that what, you know, the title of that story is somewhat misleading in terms of what you might expect from this book, because it's called The Snowman Cometh, but I don't think the snowman character actually ever has an orgasm in this comic.
No.
He does, like you say, shit himself a lot. But Gilbert means cometh in the most banal and clean way you can imagine. He just arrives, he shows up, but everybody else at this strange place,
and there's no Eugene O'Neill reference at all.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And then we get more Papoosey, who's also in the previous issues too, this porn star that is a recurring character.
Now, she wasn't in 1, though, was she?
No, she wasn't in 1, but she's in number 2.
2 and 3. So I'm guessing that she is now a regular.
Right. And I think she showed up in the last Love and Rockets.
Yes. Series,
right.
Yeah. And in fact, that second story, it's the first one that Papoosey is in. I guess it is the first one that she's in this issue. Yeah, the only one. There is a character that is watching Papoosey and Joachim. And Joachim was a character in issue number 2 as well. And that character has a Fritz-like look to her.
Yeah.
But then, as we were discussing in that last Love and Rockets book, I mean, there are just so many Fritz lookalikes that, you know, we've lost track. So to call this a Fritz-like character or someone who looks a lot like Fritz is to talk about the Fritz stories right now. So, I mean, this is that, I guess, that convergent point between the blubber world and the world of Love and Rockets.
Yeah, exactly.
By way of Fritzy.
Yeah, and which makes Gilbert's Love and Rockets, Fritz stories even more complicated and difficult to follow. But that's fine. I feel with a lot of Gilbert stuff, it's just a ride to go on.
Right. Sometimes a really nasty and disturbing ride, but.
But it's a ride that you don't have to, you have to suspend any desire for narrative sense.
Yeah. And then the way this issue ends, the last story, the last strip is on the inside back cover. And again, we have another Sartor. So he seems to keep coming back to this Sartor figure over and over again in these blubber stories. And appropriately enough, I guess. But here at the end, we almost have like a that's all, folks, ending in this last panel where this bunny creature now sticks his head out of the end of a severed penis and says, "Oh, please don't stop singing." Because the satyr had been singing when part of him broke off. So, yeah. If you've never read a blubber issue and you're trying to make sense of what Andy and I are trying to describe here, I'm sure that it's confusing. But
what I was just thinking of as we're talking about it, I really now want to do like the blubber audiobook. Because we're trying verbally to describe what's going on here, and it's nearly impossible because these creatures don't look like creatures that anything else, anybody else draws. Right. Like that satyr at the end is comes across this deflated thing that looks like something we've seen in an earlier story, and he refers to it as a Janx.
Yeah.
JNX. That means nothing, right? It just reminds me of the I don't know if you ever saw remember the Saturday Night Live sketch when Madonna's sex book came out, and they did a sketch with recording the audiobook for Madonna's sketchbook or Madonna's sex book.
Well, I don't think I saw that.
Oh, it was during like I think the Phil Hartman era, and they brought in all these celebrities to read, and Danny DeVito was the host of that episode, and he comes in and he's Al Goldstein from Screw Magazine, who's doing the audiobook. That's how I imagine what the audiobook of this would sound like. Oh, get a load of this! There's a satyr with his, whatever. Yeah. I won't go on.
Andy, if we look at what we've discussed on this week's episode, we started from a point of, let's say, gravitas and worked our way downward. We started off with the new book from Locust Moon Press, The Lost Work of Will Eisner. Then we moved on to Eleanor Davis's Libby's Dad, and then we ended up with Blubber Number 3 by Gilbert Hernandez.
I just, spoiler alert, Blubber is going to be on my top 10 for the 2016 one at the end of the year.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to do it just out of principle.
Just say you're the Comics Alternative, the only outlet, the media outlet that lists Blubber as one of its best
we'll
of 2016.
See. We'll see. I don't know. It's just, it's clear that, we said this already. It's clear Gilbert's having so much fun with it. And that fun is kind of infectious if you can, handle the stuff he's drawing.
Right. But it's not for the light of heart. It's definitely not for the puritanical.
Which is as it should be.
Right. But, as Andy pointed out at the top of the show, you can find both the current, the former issue number 2 and the upcoming issue number 4 of Blubber at a great discount if you go to the website of our sponsor. And our sponsor is Discount Comic Book Service. So check out dcbservice.com. You're going to find great deals on issues of Blubber so you can get your nasty on. But you know, you can also find copies of a lot of other comics at great discounts as well.
Clean comics, right.
Yes, we should mention that, you know, DCB Service is very democratic, right? So they sell Blubber, but also a lot of good, wholesome, all-age family stuff.
Yep.
And after you do get your comics there, be sure to get in touch with us and let us know if we're going too far in discussing Gilbert Hernandez's Blubber. If you go to our website, comicsalternative.com, you'll find that you can leave us a voice message from the comfort of your own computing device by using SpeakPipe. Or if you want to be old school about it, pick up the phone and dial 4153-COMICS. That's 415-326-6427.
Or you can get a hold of us by email. We are twoguys@comicsalternative.com. And if you want to tell me to stop talking about Blubber, you can reach me individually at andy@comicsalternative.com, and I will send you back a polite message saying no.
Yeah, and if you want to appeal to me to try to get Andy to stop talking about Blubber, you can contact me at derek@comicsalternative.com.
And we have our Twitter feed. It's @2guyswithPhDs.
That's right. But you can find us elsewhere on social media, such as on Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Google+, Goodreads, Pinterest, and YouTube. You can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. You can stream us on Stitcher. You can find us on TuneIn, on Spotify, and on iHeartRadio. Now, you can also see us as we're part of the Creative Disturbance Network. And if you're an Android user, check us out on Google Play Music. But you know, you can find every single one of our podcast episodes, as well as the reviews and comics-related commentary that we post on our blog, simply by going to our website, comicsalternative.com.
That's right. All the ways to get a hold of us, let us know how we're doing.
That's right. And we do like to hear from you, just as, you know, we like to hear from people like Wayne, Kyler, and Jason, who sent us those nice emails. So do send us those messages. We like to hear from you.
Yep.
Yep. And until next week, I'm Derek.
And I'm Andy. See ya.